Okay, so thanks for having me today. And okay, so this, well, I took a lot of time in the last minute making this slide, and I haven't had time to practice. So, this talk might be a bit hard to follow, because first is there will be a lot of math, and second, this main topic of the talk, this energy quantity, turns out to be, it's not the typical energy you're used to thinking about. So I need you to focus on it a bit. So let's begin. So human movements are well known to exhibit many characteristic features. So first, when you reach out to grab some object in the space, your hands tend to follow a straight trajectory. And the speed profile tend to have what's known as a smooth bell-shaped speed profile. And second, when you draw some curved trajectories, then the speed of your movements tend to fluctuate with the curvature of the path. And this relation between speed and curvature has been well described in terms of what's called two-third power law. Right? So those two are very basic examples. And so many theoretical models have been proposed to explain these observations. And one of the most successful ones are the models based on optimal control models. So an optimal control model is composed of two components. So first is we need a dynamic model of the body. And second, it also comes with a cost function, which describes the intrinsic cost of generating the movements. So first, X here represents the state of the body, and U is a control signal which derives the body movement. And an important aspect of the control model that represents human movements is that these models do not depend on time explicitly. So, and this property is called time symmetry. And later on, this property will come out, turns out to be quite important. So an optimal control model describes how the body makes movement over time by minimizing the accumulated total cost. Okay, if so, the body moves. All right. So for example, let's think about a straight reaching movement. Then an optimal control theory model will explain how this speed profile is generated in terms of minimizing the total cost for a given distance and duration. So this quantity, the minimum total cost, turns out to be an important quantity, and we'll call it action. And this action is generally a function of the duration of movement, as well as other movement parameters. So here, for example, the distance d. For now, for most of the cases, we'll be interested in how the action depends on time. So for notation simplicity, we'll suppress the other parameters and represent the function of time, duration. So the action turns out to be, it's a decreasing function of duration. So it means if you want to minimize the total cost, you want to make slower movement and take longer time, right? So the minimum possible, the best movement action is to move at infinite duration. Okay? In other words, don't move at all. Okay, so this shows the important limitation of the optimal control models. So this model cannot explain why we move at we make our movement with the duration that we make with. Okay? So instead, this total duration must be given to the model as an independent variable. And this feature also implies that these models require complete pre-planning before generating the movement, because the duration is only known at the end of the movement. Okay. So here we address, we propose an alternative formulation which addresses these issues. So but first we start by noticing that the duration of human movements are not completely arbitrary, but they tend to follow a stereotypical and predictable pattern. The first, the simplest example is when you make the same movement over and over, you tend to move with the same duration. Right? So that's the simplest example. And second, if you make movement over different distance, then both both the duration and also the peak speed of the movement tend to scale in increasing manner with the distance. So a typical optimum control model then will describe these three separate movements independently and without any apparent relationship between them. So how can we construct a relationship between these movements such that we will see these nice characteristic features? Okay? So a natural way to do that is to describe all these three movements as within a single optimal control problem. Right? So here, so in this extended problem, we'll try to minimize the total action over all three movements. Okay, so minimize A1 plus A2 plus A3. Under the constraint, however, that the total duration, T1 plus T2 and T3, is fixed. Okay? And in this formulation, the optimal solution turns out to follow a very simple rule, which from basic calculus, that the partial derivative of the action with respect to time is all the same between these three movements. So this is what's shared between these movements. And in fact, this quantity turns out to be important. So we will define this derivative of respect to time as energy. Okay, and in terms of that, now this relation between these three movements are simply can be said that the energy of each movement are all the same between them. Gary?
I'm already confused because clearly moving farther takes more energy. So
So when you make a farther movement, what increases is the total cost. But then this derivative of the action turns out to be the same between all the movements. Oh, it will take some time until you build up the right intuition. Okay. Okay. So.
So instead of calling it energy, you should call it
heart.
Right.
No, this is a difficult problem because it isn't the same as physical energy. This is a different kind of energy.
Right.
Just call it mental energy or something.
Uh-huh. Okay. So the action is, as I showed you before, is a decreasing function of time, duration, and also the derivative also tend to follow a similar decreasing pattern. So you can think of this energy, E, as something that represents how fast you're moving. So when you're moving slow with longer duration, the energy tends to be lower. Okay, so that's one way to look at it. So this prediction that I explained before turns out to explain the human movement, how the human movement duration is determined. But then before I showed you the comparison with the data, let's first look at why this energy quantity is important. So first of all, this action and energy quantity turns out to be definable in every moment in time. Okay? So not only between these discrete chunks of movements, but at every moment in time throughout the movement. And when you consider such energy, right, this energy profile turns out to be constant throughout time, although the speed is fluctuating up and down. And this energy conservation turns out to be, it's not some trivial result, but it comes out directly from the fact that our model, the limb dynamics and as well as the cost function, do not include any dependence on time. So it comes directly from time symmetry. And we can see this as a result of what's known as Noether's theorem in physics, which says if there is any continuous symmetry in the problem, there always exists a corresponding conserved quantity. And the conserved quantity that's associated with time symmetry in physics is called energy. And in fact, this definition is exactly the same as a physics definition of energy. That's why I call it energy. All right, so as I mentioned before, this energy conservation formulation turns out to explain how human duration is determined. Then there is one one problem with this formulation, right? So this, in order to determine how long each movement takes, T1 and T2 and T3, we need to know, we need to be given a total time, right? So that's a required quantity. And then given this constraint, we can determine each movement duration by fixing the individual energy to be the same. So that's the problem. Right now, this formulation implies that we need to plan ahead three movements in order to determine how long the first movement will take, right? And this three movements is just a number I chose for illustration. But then in general, this result implies that we have to plan ahead up to like indefinite number of movement in the future, right? So that's definitely implausible. And so here's an alternative way to look at this problem, which fixes the problem. So, oops. Okay. So my animation got out of order. But so instead of using T as an independent variable, we can use the energy as independent variable. Okay. So that means, mathematically, this mathematical process of changing the independency between energy and time is called Legendre transformation. And let's see. So intuitively explaining, what this transformation implies is that, in the original formulation, we were given some time, a duration for movement, and we were determining how fast we need to move in order to satisfy that duration constraint, right? This alternative formulation says, well, instead, we'll decide how fast we want to move, and that will determine how long the movement will take. So that's what it means to use energy as independent parameter instead. Okay, and that turns out to be a much better formulation. So here I'll show you analysis of our model, and it'll be mostly done for the simple cost function. It's called squared jerk. So jerk is a second derivative of velocity, and this cost function has been used quite a lot to explain many movements in humans. And for this cost function, it turns out the energy quantity that's related to that is this complicated form. I hope you don't need to remember that. But then, here is a simple example for straight movement, once again. So for movement over distance d and duration t, the action and energy quantity turns out to be have this form. It depends on both distance and time. And the Legendre transform of this formulation gives you exactly inverse of this relationship, right? So now here, the duration is expressed as function of energy and distance. And the only thing we need to care right now is that this relationship implies that duration will be proportional to distance to one-third power for fixed energy. And in turn, that means the peak speed, which is distance over time, will be proportional to distance to the power. And in fact, so we did experiments to confirm these predictions. So here, by the way, we asked subjects to draw multiple straight movements, and we recorded their movement on a tablet device. And indeed, our measurement confirms that the peak speed of the movements tend to follow two-third power of the distance. So that confirms our prediction. And second example is when we ask the subject to draw a circle drawing movement. Okay? And one feature about the circling movement is that in the middle of the movement, the speed profiles tend to be flat in the middle. And here we will describe how fast the movement is during this region in terms of the radius of the circle and the angular distance and duration. And it turns out for these movements, the action and energy can be represented in terms of T, R, and theta. And the Legendre transformation, again, gives you inverse of this relation and represents time as energy and radius and data. It turns out a quite simple form, right? So the duration turns out to be proportional to radius to 1/3 power, and it turns out to be linear to the angular distance, right? So this linear part turns out to make a lot of sense. So it means that when you're drawing circle like 10 times, it will take 10 times longer than drawing one single circle, right? And that makes a lot of sense. And a non-trivial part is this part. It's proportional to radius to 1/3 power. And this flat region, this speed, really turns out to proportional to radius to 2/3 power. And again, we confirmed that in measurements where subjects were drawing multiple different circles with different radii. And here I'm plotting the local radius of curvature as the subject draw the circle. And here is the speed of movement. There's a lot of oscillation here because, of course, the subjects never draw a perfect circle, but then it's a bit elliptic. That's why there's a lot of oscillation. So we took a low-pass filter of the data, and there are these thick lines. And again, when we compare the relation between the radius and this peak speed, they turn out to lie on this prediction line quite nicely, which is a 2/3 power, 1/3 power prediction. Okay. All right. Ooh. Right. Yeah. I ran out of time when I was making this slide, so I copied from all the slides. Well, is that right? Yeah. So one result that we need to focus on is the fact that the duration of the movement turns out to be proportional to length scale to 1/3 power, both in straight and circle drawing movements. Right. So for the reaching movements, the duration was proportional to distance to 1/3 power, while in circle drawing, it was proportional to radius to 1/3 power. And in fact, this statement can be made more generally, that for any shape of movement, if you make this movement size to be magnified by factor alpha, then the time profile of the movement will be scaled by 1/3 power of alpha, and the speed will be scaled by alpha to 2/3 power. Okay, I won't go through the details of why that's the case. Okay. And this scaling relation between length and time can be applied to quite nicely for the spiral movement. So spiral has this nice property that when you zoom in, when you magnify the trajectory, you get the same spiral again. That's called self-similarity. And this 1/3 power law, a scaling law, implies that for the spiral, this 1/3 power law should apply within the curve as well. So if you look at the radius of curvature and the speed relation for this curve, our theory predicts that they will follow this 1/3 power law prediction. And our data confirms that quite nicely. In fact, this result is quite surprising because, the relation between curvature and speed has been known to follow what's known as 2/3 power law. Okay? And indeed, our result, our prediction, and also the experimental results for the case of ellipse turns out to reproduce that 2/3 power law relation quite nicely. So there is something strange going on. So people used to think that this 2/3 power law is quite universal. It should apply for any kind of curve drawing. But our prediction says, hey, in fact, we can find a different exponent for spiral. Okay. And this was, in fact, quite confusing for me for a while. Okay. And I want you to feel the same confusion. So let's think about this interesting case. So what about what will happen if you're drawing an elliptic spiral? Right. So it's both ellipse and also spiral. So how many of you think it will follow a 1/3 power law? You raise your hand. No? Okay. How about 2/3 power law? Oh, yeah. How about both? What does that even mean? What about neither? right. Okay, look carefully. So this is what happens. Ooh, I put some animation there. Okay. So the result is both, right? So when you draw this elliptic spiral, each cycle of the ellipse will follow Tudor power law, but as the movement increases in size, this Tudor power law line will move along the Wander power law line. So it's quite interesting phenomenon. Okay. And our energy conservation theory also predicts many details about other kinds of curve drawing as well. So here are three different instances of curved shapes, and our prediction, the green line, falls on the data quite nicely. So it explains different kind of movement as well. And this result, this summarizes the most of the result that we got. So what we found is that the relation between the curvature and speed does not follow a particular power law with some fixed exponent. But depending on which shape you draw, the exponent can change between from 1/3 to 2/3 and up to 1. And here I'm showing all the various power law with different slope. So and this result is predicted by our energy conservation model, and it's confirmed quite nicely in experiments as well. Okay. Ooh. Right, and I ran out of time when I was making a conclusion slide. So that's the end. Okay. All right, thank you. Any questions? Yeah, Howard?
So how much of this do you think is due to just the biomechanical properties of the arm and so forth, or how much of it's neural, or do you see a one-to-one correspondence there, or hypothesize?
Right. Well, there were attempts to explain this Tudor power law observation in terms of the passive mechanics of the limb and the tendons, and there's a paper which reports that they could reproduce Tudor power law with such a simple model, but then I doubt it can also explain reproduce this whole variety of power law for different shape movements. So I don't know how far you can go with that.
All of those results are based on assuming that you're minimizing the jerk squared, mm-hmm. right? And so you have to say, is there something special about the jerk? Mm-hmm. And that's where you need to relate it to the actual dynamical plant. And it doesn't necessarily have to follow either because of the mechanical properties or the neural properties, but somehow the planning property, yeah.
Right.
In the context of, but that's now we've identified a quantity, right, that explains everything. So your focus now is going to be on trying to relate your planning in the brain to the jerk, right?
Is there a particular brain region, premotor cortex, that you would naturally think to look at first, or network, or?
Well, we're starting with motor cortex, and seeing what the relationships should be there in terms of the, looking at the equations of motion that you have to need in order to be able to control the limb, right? Mm-hmm. So we've actually have a whole story. You've already heard the story from the work on cross products, right? Being represented by individual firing rates of neurons in the motor cortex, Cosin tuning curves. And then the question then is, how do you take all of those the population firing rates in the motor cortex and plan the trajectory using those motion primitives? So that would be now going to the premotor cortex, and that's something that we're just beginning to do.
Thank you.
Well, and in order to answer one part of your question, I also studied looking at what happens when people look at movements that follow this curved trajectories. And it turns out that this movement looks most natural. It looks smoothest, or it looks like the movements happen at constant speed. In fact, if the speed profile follows this predictive power law. And so for ellipse, it looks like the dot is moving at a constant speed if it follows two-third power law. For spiral, it has to be one-third power law. And somehow, although the speed is always changing, in fact, by a lot, it looks like it's moving at constant speed. And so there's something very interesting going on in the perception, visual perception as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
All right.
So there's lots of things I like about this, doing optimal control and everything. Yeah. But at the same time, I have to feel it's almost an example, I'm going to say this, of what we don't want to do. It's almost the opposite of what we want to do, because you've chosen to use your own names for standard things. You know, you call something the action in optimal control, it's because of the cost to goal or the value function.
Right. And I'm using a physics notation. Yeah.
Yeah, you're using a whole different notation for something that we already have, like already multiple notations. We should be going from the multiple ones we have to fewer.
Well, I'm not adding yet another one for confused people, but then in fact it draws a lot of intuition from physics. That's why that was the intention. Yeah,
I understand, but I think it's the wrong direction.
Okay.
We should be unifying, not making multiple names for the same thing.
No, but the quantity doesn't correspond to anything.
The quantity called energy corresponds to the Bellman error, and actually the idea that the energy is the derivative of the cost to go function. You call it action, it's the cost to go function. The derivative of the cost to go function, everyone knows, is something that should be zero. You know, it's related to the TD error. Okay, and all these relationships.
That's not true.
Well, maybe they are. Maybe they are. You're using a totally different names, and if they're.
Well, it's just a name, but like the root is the same, anyways, regardless of the name. So, the root of action with respect to time is not zero.
I didn't say it is zero. You're saying the energy. You did say the energy
is conserved.
Is conserved.
Right.
It's not zero.
It's not zero. It's some constant number.
No, Rich, you're absolutely right. It's really confusing, and we've gone around the bush several times calling it many different things. At one point, we were calling it mojo. And then we thought maybe even a better word would be MO. And it isn't a court that it really is a different quantity from the ones that you're familiar with. But it does come out directly from analyzing the physics of the motion.
The whole notion of minimum jerk actually is also well known.
No, that's the dynamical part. This is that's one term in the mojo.
So, I mean. So the notion of analyzing motion to minimize jerk is well done. I mean, it's well known.
Yeah, no, that was a starting point. Right.
Right.
That's where everybody starts there. But what Ben has done is to go beyond that.
Okay, well, he didn't discuss. I don't see that it's going beyond it. He didn't discuss what's already been done with minimum jerk. It just feels like we're repeating things that have been done many times.
So if what you say is true, then everybody should already know that the two-thirds power law is wrong, right? And they don't. Everybody still believes in it.
Well, I don't know, you didn't review what people know about minimum jerk work.
No, this is not minimum jerk. This is the two-thirds power law we're talking about, that people the dozens of papers in the literature all proving that that's the way it should be in general, and it's true for the ellipse, but it's not true for any other movement.
Yeah, the minimum jerk model directly leads to the conclusion that the velocity curvature relationship is a two-thirds power law. I mean, that's the starting point.
So then, is this more than that, or is this starting there?
If I interpret this correctly, what Ben is saying, that's a special case of a more general law in which you have staggered two-thirds power law depending on the shape. If I understood it.
Yeah, I think Rich is illustrating that
scientists would much rather use each other's toothbrush than notation. We do need to move on. So I'm going to ask that Ben step down and then step outside with Rich.